May it please the Court, I'm Douglas Mishkin. I represent the appellant, Christina Comer. The Texas Education Agency fired its director of science for forwarding an email about a lecture by a professor who lectures that creationism should not be taught as science. They gave her a termination memo, which was quite specific about the reason for her termination. They said in the memo, which is in the record at page 31, you compromised the agency's role in the TEKS, the curriculum revision process, by creating the perception that the agency has a biased position on a subject, teaching creationism, directly related to the science education curriculum.
How does that establish? Let's assume that this policy is unfair, that maybe its implementation may have been a violation of free speech rights. How does her losing her job for violation of an invalid, let's say for purpose of invalid policy, constitute an establishment as opposed to a free speech claim? I mean, you could teach creationism in a university, right?
You can teach creationism in a context other than in a science class in a public school.
Right. So she writes an email to people about a particular lecture and her inability to communicate the way she wants about or inform people is an establishment claim?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Now, what is your best argument for how this is an establishment claim?
It's similar to Freiler, which we submit is not simply a roadmap, but indeed gives directions as well. In Freiler, the issue was the disclaimer. And this court did the analysis after analyzing the purpose argument, went to the effects.
But that was a different context. That was in school. That was I think it was sophomore, it was high school class. And they had a disclaimer. And there was a way that could, I think the court suggested to them how to write their disclaimer. but this disclaimer had the effect of telling them, hold on to your religion. We don't want you to give up your religious things when you're studying science. And so they actually were injecting a religion or their preference in the classroom, in a science classroom. Here we've got a lady that's mature lady that's been working for an agency for a long time, and she's sending these emails to mature people that are members of science organizations. I don't see the relationship between, and I'm very familiar with Friday, and the facts here.
Here's the relationship, Judge. What Aguillard stands for is that creationism cannot be a part of a science curriculum. The cases that have come before, yes, we have the you can't do a disclaimer in the classroom, you can't put a sticker on a biology textbook. But this isn't an issue of whether an act takes place in the classroom or outside the classroom. The issue is, where is the impact of the act felt? And what we have here is an attempt to do indirectly what the agency could not do directly. What they're doing indirectly is saying to the director of science for the curriculum division, do your job as if creationism were science. So we know from the agency's own documents in the record that job involved answering questions from legislators. So when you're talking with legislators, talk as if creationism were science. When you're giving guidance to teachers, which is part of the agency's mission and part of the director's job, when you're talking with teachers, do so as if creationism were science. And the problem here is that it is not as direct as standing up in class. You can hear the disclaimer, you can see the sticker, but nonetheless, it still can affect the science education curriculum, but in a more pernicious way, because when the legislator gets an answer to his or her question, that person will never know whether the director of science pulled her punch because she's supposed to operate as if creationism were science. And the teacher who seeks guidance from the director of science for the curriculum division will never know whether the guidance he or she got was constrained in some fashion because the director of science had to act as if creationism were science. The problem with what the agency said it did to Ms. Comer, and it's quite clear from the termination memo, leaving aside whatever gloss the agency may put on in its brief, it's clear in the memo. The problem is it still is equating creationism with science, we know it can't do that.
Setting aside judicial immunity, let's say I tell my clerks, I don't want you discussing politics. I don't want you discussing issues that we have before me that I will decide in public. And one of the things that I tell them to do is, I don't want you getting involved in public discussing the merits of evolution and creationism. And one of my law clerks wants to tell people that I've got a case pending that's going to have this going on, and she sends it to a select a group of people because she wants them to show up at the hearing. How am I establishing religion? If I was a state judge, let's say.
You're not, and nothing about our argument would suggest that you'd be constrained in any way from giving that kind of direction to your clerk. The issue here is that the agency's sole reason for this this decision that they made is they don't want to appear biased about teaching creationism so that the board can make its own curriculum decision. That's the justification.
But and the isn't problem the is board empowered in Texas to make curriculum decisions?
Not unconstitutional decisions. And the board is not empowered to decide to teach creationism. That's what Aguilar says.
Well, Kelsey, let me work backwards from your argument then. Your position is the Board of Education could never adopt creationism as part of the text, if that's the way to put in the acronym, curriculum. Correct.
Not as part of the science curriculum.
Part of science, correct. Working backwards from that, therefore, for the Texas Education Agency to take the position that someone like Ms. Comer can't discuss publicly the propriety of doing that is also unconstitutional and as an establishment. It seems to me that that is your argument, and there's a breakdown there. It's one thing to say the State Board of Education cannot adopt it in the context you're talking about. It's something else for the Texas Agency Education Agency not be able to tell. We don't care if it's a good curriculum or bad curriculum or even unconstitutional curriculum. Don't get in the way of the Board of Education's decision. That is their decision to make. Don't be taking stands on this. Isn't that different?
The agency can say that for issues that are actually before the board or anticipated to be before the board, that are legitimately before the board.
Why the last? Why legitimately? Why is that necessary? Insofar as taking a position that you cannot get in the way of the State Board of Education's decision-making. That's for them to decide with their lawyers as to what's legitimate.
But there's nothing to get in the way of when the issue is teaching creationism. Aguilar makes it clear the agency doesn't dispute creationism cannot be taught in the science curriculum. There's no legitimate interest left for the board to assert, for the agency to assert, that it needs to remain not biased against that. And we hasten to add, on this record, there is nothing from the board suggesting that the board wished to keep that option open. And we submit it's no accident that there's nothing from the board to say that, because had the board submitted such a statement, it would be admitting that it was contemplating an unconstitutional option. So as a factual matter...
Isn't this a political question in turn? I mean, what you're really saying is you're questioning the board's motives, and you're free to do that, with respect to how they want the people of Texas informed. This person still got to come. He still, I assume, he made a speech. People still showed up. But her failure to follow a directive, and even if it wasn't a failure, somehow becomes an establishment. I mean, the guy still came, he still spoke, but her inability and her getting fired for telling people about it is, according to you, an establishment claim. And, I mean, I can see a free speech claim. I mean, you're a smart lawyer. I'm sure you didn't avoid that free speech question because you didn't think of it. And there's no briefing on the due process, the notice question, which is would appear on its face to be a viable or at least arguable, but you're wanting us to get into this issue on establishment. And if this looks like to me a First Amendment claim in the robe of an establishment claim.
Your Honor, let me back up to the beginning of your comment. You said something to the effect about the board in its role of educating people. This is not about the board. The board is not a party. The board has not been heard from in this lawsuit, and there's nothing on the record to suggest that the board wishes to preserve the option of teaching creationism. This is entirely about the agency firing its director of science for forwarding, FYI, an email announcing a lecture by Professor Forrest.
What's the relief she sought in the complaint?
She seeks declaratory relief that the agency may not have any policy that is premised upon being, quote, neutral about teaching creationism. And she seeks injunctive relief that she be offered reinstatement into her position.
Because of the former.
Excuse me, Judge?
Because of the former.
That's correct, that she was fired pursuant to it was an unconstitutional action to fire her for the reason that the agency stated, and she's entitled to reinstatement in that position.
Seems like a roundabout way to get reinstated. I mean, it just seems a very circuitous route to get reinstatement for, you know, illegal termination. I'm not passing on, you know, where your argument ultimately goes, but just been twirling in my head, you know, at bottom line, reinstatement, you know, was a remedy. You know, much of the district court's opinion, you know, talks about the same things we are. And it's just hard for me to fathom something is more of a labyrinth than the Supreme Court's Establishment Clause jurisprudence. And so trying to fit, you know, this claim uniquely within there to get to the end sum, at least for me, is, I'm saying you can't be done, but it, I don't know, it's somehow a little elusive, I'll just put it that way. So.
We see a parallel with Freiler. If after this court ruled that the disclaimer in Freiler were unconstitutional, if that school board had then fired its director of science for failing to appear unbiased about the disclaimer, surely that wouldn't have stood. And after Aguillard, it doesn't stand that a director of science can be fired for being unbiased about teaching creationism when Aguillard says you can't teach it. Before the authorities move me forcibly to the side of the road, let me add, the relief we seek is, as I say, but alternatively, at the least, we think the district court erred in granting summary judgment against Director Comer when it did so based upon factual findings that it was making against her, as opposed to the way Rule 56 operates, and construing facts and construing inferences against her, and based on things that were not in the record, although argued in the agency's brief.
When you come back on rebuttal, you know, address, I mean, the appeal is from the judgment, not from the district court's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I remind my law clerks of that frequently. So it's not so much what he said in this case, but I mean, it's the judgment. But part of what the state, or at least I thought the agency opined, was yes, the terminating memo, but that there were these other prior instances in which your client had disobeyed or not followed some other precepts that sort of lead up to this. Now, obviously, the termination letter, quote, speaks for itself, but at least it's in the briefing that they're, you know, building up to here, and here's the termination. So when you come back up on rebuttal, I'm sure it'll be in the purview of what the state can address, just at least address that, if you will.
I will. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Poe.
May it please the court. The TEA has a valid and a secular interest in ensuring not only the actual impartiality, but also the appearance of impartiality of its employees. After all, the authority of the TEA is limited to what the state's curriculum is, not what it should be. So the TEA requires its employees to remain silent and neutral on matters of curriculum policy that are reserved to the Board of Education.
Counsel, it seems to me that this is not in the case, but isn't there a factual issue that could have been made in this case of whether her sending FYI an email of this nature is even a violation of whatever policy you're talking about?
It could be a factual issue. It is not a factual issue in this case.
Well, all I'm talking about, Judge Benavides, is addressed some legal issues that are not in this case. It seems to me there are factual issues that have not been raised in this case either, almost as if this case is being made to stand for something, that it's not the easiest thing to make it stand for.
I guess my primary response would be it's undisputed because plaintiffs have not disputed it.
I don't know why it's not neutral for her to let people know that people are coming to the state. I mean, she didn't say, I espouse this person's position. I recommend that you go to him because I agree with him. He's a great person who speaks authority. I mean, all she's doing is informing people that this person is going to come and make this. How is she, other than just, how is her informing people of something that's going to happen, some event, become a comment on things that are going to be before the board?
I think I understand Your Honor's question, both Your Honor's question. Ultimately, the email, I guess, only said FYI, so what's the issue there? And I think I have several answers. For one, plaintiffs don't dispute that this email violated the neutrality policy. To the contrary, their own complaint at page 26 of the record concedes that her email did, in fact, violate the TEA neutrality policy.
Concedes
only question
or
whether
assert,
it's constitutional.
Perhaps. I would say it's an assertion that it's a violation as opposed to a concession.
Well, it's certainly, they're not disputing it, put it that way. It is stipulated for the record, or it is, I don't want to be technical about it, but they don't contest that there was a violation of the policy. And moreover, look at the context. Look at the context of the email. This was an email that was sent to a listserv, an official listserv of various teachers and administrators from her official government email account, an email account that was assigned, after all, to the director of the science curriculum, and it was the job of the director of the science curriculum to disseminate official information about the state's curriculum for the TEA. So it was reasonable, certainly, for the TEA to have a concern about a breach of impartiality. And notably, Ms. Comer tried to correct it immediately. This is a policy of employee neutrality. And neutrality is the touchstone of the Establishment Clause, and certainly not a violation of it.
Mr. Ho, how do we know the contours of this policy? It seems to me her dismissal letter refers to a specific directive she had gotten several months earlier. But there's also an overarching policy that's unwritten, is my understanding. What is in the record that identifies with some specificity of what this policy is, independent of the directive that she got in February 07.
Sure. There are a number of examples in the record that confirm that this policy is a policy of neutrality and applies generally to any issue of curriculum policy that is within the Board of Education and, more importantly, outside the power of the TEA. Page 30 through 32, page 205, and pages 210 through 212 all establish repeatedly that this is a generalized policy that applies to all curriculum issues. In particular, I would note that Comer herself violated the neutrality policy before this creation of Zemina Bale. She violated it in a totally different context, dealing with a dispute about the chemistry and physics curriculum, that on page 32.
Is there any evidence that anybody else had ever had this policy, had violated this policy insofar as any penalty brought against them or any kind of discipline brought against them?
I believe the record reflects that there were other instances, both her and others, violating the policy. In terms of sanctions, I don't believe the record reflects that one way or the other. Our point here, of course, is
they argue in their brief that no one else was ever fired for a violation. And now you say that there's also evidence that there was violations by other people.
I believe there was certainly the evidence of her violation in terms of this chemistry and physics issue, and I believe in the affidavit between pages 210 and 212, there's discussion about other employees who had breached neutrality, and they were asked not to do that. What makes this case unique is that this is really a pattern of misconduct. There's a number of instances of insubordination, including but certainly not limited to these multiple violations of the neutrality policy.
Was this a progressive discipline in the prior incident with the chemistry? Is there something that she got saying, you know, any other violations will lead to termination or could or whatever for violating the same policy?
Yes, on page 30, there's a reference to, I think it's a letter of counseling that she had received in light of some of her insubordinate acts. She was basically engaged in activities without the TEA's authority, going to events, participating and discussing things publicly that she was not authorized to discuss, both in terms of violation of neutrality and just generally speaking, sort of speaking ultra vires, not having authority. And it was really this record, this building up of all these different incidents. You know, the TEA tried to give her a second chance, a third chance. I think it was, frankly, pretty reasonable in terms of trying to ask her not to do this. Obviously, it came to a head at some point, both this creationism email issue. And in addition, there was actually another incident temporarily after this email where she, again, attended an event without authorization. And it was at that point that the TEA said, well, you know, it's time. This is not working out. And all that is discussed, again, pages 30 through 32 of the record.
Would you address counsel's reliance on Freiler?
Sure. Freiler, it really doesn't apply squarely here. And if anything, it might arguably help us. First of all, Freiler is really a narrow and carefully crafted opinion. It only applies, it applies as a disclaimer issue. And the court said, I think, two things. One, there's essentially a suggestion that it would have been okay had the disclaimer really truly been neutral, just to avoid offense. The problem in Freiler was that the disclaimer went beyond that. I think the court actually used the words, this is more than a disclaimer, because it's affirmatively encouraging students to think about the Bible. But a neutral disclaimer, a true policy of neutrality, probably would have survived the analysis that this court set out in Freiler. I want to also note, Your Honor mentioned the issue of free speech. And I, to be candid, I sort of share Your Honor's curiosity. It is, we would submit, ultimately, this would be sort of a more interesting question, if you will. This seems more shaped in the free speech framework than in the Establishment Clause framework. Ultimately, we do submit it's telling that the plaintiffs didn't bring a free speech claim, and that's because it's essentially precluded by this court's opinion in Nixon versus City of Houston, where the court looked at the Garcetti and Pickering framework.
Because of Garcetti.
Exactly. In fact, this case is easier than Nixon because it's so squarely within her official duties, official email, that sort of thing. Make no mistake, Ms. Comer is an at-will employee. So the only legal issue before this court, the only issue she presents to this court, it's not whether the policy and the action taken under the policy, it's not whether it's wise or even necessary, but rather whether it is religious or secular in either its purpose or effect. And it is, frankly, we would submit, difficult to imagine how simply telling an employee, please be silent on certain sensitive topics for your employer, how that could somehow rise to a religious policy. In conclusion, this court recently observed in Croft versus Perry, which is a very different case, but I'd like to explain why it's somewhat analogous. In Croft versus Perry, the court concluded that even an official moment of silence as an actual component of the public school day, so you could submit actual part of the curriculum, silence is not inherently religious. And if that is so, then certainly a policy of silence in this kind of case, in the workplace, is not religious either. To the contrary, we would submit that the policy serves the valid and secular interest in ensuring both the actual impartiality and the appearance of impartiality by TEA employees.
Let me ask you one of the points that Mr. Michigan Rose raised. Let's say that it was absolutely clear, it had already been addressed either in litigation involving Texas, and it may be a fair statement regardless, that creationism as a part of the science curriculum could not be taught. The seminar that she sent the email about was specifically about the problems of teaching creationism as part of the science curriculum. Would it therefore be exempt from some policy for her to have sent this email? If this could not be considered by the Board of Education, there's no evidence it was being considered by the Board of Education as a matter of curriculum, why isn't this in a way exempt from your neutrality?
I want to clue in on that word that you're using, exempt, because I think that's helpful to this discussion. To begin with, the building block I think we would submit is, I don't think there should be any question, this is a valid policy generally, right? The policy of neutrality, impartiality, there's no question in our minds that it's a valid general policy. So really the only question is, does the Constitution force an exemption of some kind? And we would submit that there's really nothing in the Constitution that we're aware of that would require an exemption. To begin with, we're serving precisely the same valid and secular interest in wanting to achieve actual and the appearance of impartiality. Simply put, the TEA doesn't want its employees to be out there as advocates, as combatants in these social policy issues, particularly the more emotional social policy issues. We don't want the employees to be contributing to the volume of the debate, if you will, and that's true regardless of the content. The same policy would have been violated had she did an email in support of creationism or in any other policy position. There is a big difference between a government agency requiring an employee to do something unconstitutional, to participating in an unconstitutional program. Big difference between that, we would submit, and what's going on here, which is simply asking an employee, please refrain from talking about something that might be unconstitutional. The plaintiffs don't claim that we're doing the former. There's no allegation of an unconstitutional curriculum here, another reason why Freiler doesn't apply. And we don't defend that, I should add. We're not saying that we could force somebody to do something that is unconstitutional.
If you put it in the Freiler context, and it wasn't a disclaimer, there wasn't a disclaimer, but you had that classroom, and the principal tells all the teachers, and the board talks to the principal and directs it to tell all the teachers in your class, do not make any comments or discuss whether you're for or against the teaching of creationism or creation in your science classes. Do not discuss your views either for or against creationism. That would get the facts more in line with the analysis in Freiler as opposed to a waiver thing. Would that be a violation?
I certainly agree with Your Honor. That would be closer to those cases and to be candid, more interesting. I think it would depend on the record of the particular case. What is the purpose, for example, why have those statements? We are talking there about actually
teaching
students.
Well, it wouldn't be taking a position one way or the other. The only way you could get into it is if the teacher injected herself or her views about creationism, and it seems like the board would have an interest in not getting involved in those kind of things. Just teach the science class and don't engage the students in a discussion about creationism one way or the other. That's not, we're here to teach science the way it's laid out.
I think we would acknowledge that would be a more complicated case. Here, we frankly aren't being neutral in a sense. I mean, the Board of Education's curriculum is evolution as part of science and nothing else. I think that would be a closer case.
Come back to the FYI. I assume that in Ms. Comer's role, she, forwards emails or sends emails as a matter of course frequently to various and sundry people, whether in this listserv or others, just simply because. Would that be generally true?
I don't think the record reflects that one way either. She asserts that.
Yeah, well, I guess what I'm getting at, you know, somebody who never sends an email to anybody, suddenly, you know, you send this email out contextually, I see that. But unless there's something unique about the listserv group itself, which you alluded to as a point, if she's sending or forwarding emails just as a part of her job in general, sending out general information, was it something unique about sending this FYI, because that's all it said, is FYI. There's no sentence, no anything other than FYI. So, you know, no matter who the speaker was or whatever, if in the course of her job she sends out these emails, it troubled me some to figure out exactly why this email, though I get the argument, but if you send out 100 emails in the course of a year, this is one of 100 emails forwarded to this listserv group, many of which the recipients toss, trash, delete, you know, never read, as we all do, get a whole bunch of emails. Is it coming back to the fact that she was an at-will employee, that because she sent this one, never mind the other 99, she's at-will employee, the policy says what it says, she can just be canned? I mean, is that what it really gets down to?
Well, I guess there are several ways to address that. One is, I'm not aware of any other emails that she sent that, frankly, would have violated the neutrality policy. Certainly not any emails that she sent that plaintiff concedes.
I didn't mean others that violated the policy. Just sure. If you're in the business of, you know, just sending a whole bunch of emails. She sends this because I generally send emails that are of some interest, like many of us do. If something comes in, Chambers, I think my law clerks might find of interest. You know, I forward it to them. Never mind not making a comment on it. Just here's something you should know, you know, whatever it is. It might come from whomever, the Federalist Society or American Constitution Society. So I was trying to get some sense of it. Was it just this email and to who it went to?
Well, I think one can draw a distinction between an email that says, here's some event about some sort of generally interesting issue in the world, versus this email, which was about a sensitive curriculum issue on which the Board of Education had the authority and on which one can assume she is the director of science curriculum. Perhaps it would be different if she were the director of the math curriculum, but she is in charge of the science area. One of her responsibilities, as plaintiff notes, is to communicate with teachers about what is the curriculum. And within that special context, the fact that she would send an email that clearly, certainly the underlying email takes a position.
The nature of her job, you know, it's just like if one of us forwards an email to somebody versus a law clerk or somebody else forward, it could be the same forward, but the fact that it comes from an Article 3 carries some imprimatur. So you argue, part because of her position in forwarding the email, it's carrying sort of an implicit imprimatur, a commentary beyond FYI.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And more importantly, at least it was reasonable, and permissible for the TEA to have a concern because she carries this position, because this email seems to suggest a position on something within her her curriculum area, but not within her legal authority.
All right, well, let me back up to one more point. I'll turn you loose. Counsel opposite ended with the termination letter itself and saying that, well, the termination letter itself, the board is essentially equating creationism with science, et cetera. I mean, speak to the content of the termination letter itself. Is there something from the state's viewpoint that's inartful or something that has a meaning other than what was given to it?
Sure. No, the termination at 30 to 32, I think, speaks quite clearly that she was not supposed to cross the line into providing guidance or opinions about instructional methodology or any other matters for which we, the TEA, have no statutory authority. We should ensure that it does not appear in any way that an employee is advocating for any given position or stance. Again, speaking generally about any curriculum issue. This memo specifically talks about a number of other incidents where she was insubordinate, including that one incident I talked about in terms of the chemistry and physics, where she had violated neutrality in a totally different area of curriculum policy. Finally, I do want to note that on page 205, there's a discussion about what Comer is allowed to say and what she's not allowed to say. If a teacher had asked her, what is the curriculum of the state of Texas, then of course she can answer, the science curriculum in this area is evolution. And that's what's made clear at the record at 205. The problem here is she went beyond that, and she sent an email that certainly at least suggested that she was taking an official advocacy position on a debate that was really properly before the board.
But if you're saying she's taking an advocacy position, she's taking an advocacy position consistent with what the policy is. I mean, I guess, if she would have been advocating someone that wanted creationism to be injected in the schools, that would be against the policy. But when she's saying somebody's coming that ostensibly from the title is not going to endorse creationism, that would seem consistent with the fact that the board hasn't, and you do not contend that the board is trying to advocate creationism in the schools. So there's a little bit of a disconnect, because I agree that there are some factual questions that I have that apparently aren't before us. We take this case on the basis that this was the policy, this was the alleged violation, and this alleged violation violates the establishment clause. So that's what we have before us, whether we like it or not. I guess that's where we're at.
I know my time has expired. Mm-hmm. In terms of the factual issues, the facts are essentially undisputed. That's why both sides move for summary judgment. So this is, I think we think it's right for summary judgment. To use Your Honor's earlier law clerk analogy, it would be like a law clerk. Maybe the judges have already decided what they're going to rule on, and so maybe the law clerk just wants to tell the world before they rule, and to agree with the judges. The fact that the law clerk may agree with the judge doesn't obviously authorize the law clerk to speak out of school. Ultimately, the case, we would remind, is about constitutionality, religious, not whether it's wise or necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. You have 5 minutes left to establish your case.
Before I address Judge Stewart's question, I want to pick up, Judge Benavides, where you were. When a student says to a teacher in a science class, I've been hearing all about this creationism, is creationism science? That teacher, of course, has to be able to respond, no, it is not, and here's why. Because teaching science implies that students understand what science is not as well as what it is. But the agency's position is that when that teacher calls the director of science for the curriculum division and says, help me out, I have students asking me, is creationism science? What should I say? The agency's answer is, say, evolution is in the curriculum, creationism isn't. But that's not an answer you can give to a fifth grader or an eighth grader. Why isn't it in the curriculum? And the director of science for the curriculum division has to be able to say, because it's not science, it's a religious belief. And let me make an important distinction here. When the question is, in an astronomy class, should we teach astrology? Of course not. Why? Because astrology is not science. It's a set of beliefs. But the difference is, they're not religious beliefs, and this becomes an Establishment Clause issue when we start equating something that is not science with something that is. And that's the problem with this so-called neutrality, which, of course, is not neutral at all. It takes something that's not science and treats it as it is. That was the problem in Aguillard. So-called balanced treatment offends the Establishment Clause because it's treating a religious belief as something else. Judge, with respect to the other acts that the agency makes reference to, they're irrelevant for our purposes today. This is not what in employment law we call a mixed motive case. Those are situations where an employer says, I have four reasons I could have fired this employee. If one of them is bad, I still have the other three, and I can show you I would have fired this person for those reasons. In this case, the agency cannot say that because, in this case, the agency did not terminate Ms. Comer when any of those other supposed bad things happened.
Well, it wouldn't make any difference. I mean, if this is an establishment claim, then, and if you've made a claim, if you've got a case that survives summary judgment on the law, then what difference would it make that she had been disciplined in the past? I mean, it seems that there's no dispute here that she was ultimately fired as a result of her sending out this thing.
That's correct. And the agency
itself. If that's a claim, that's a claim. It wouldn't make any difference whether she'd been, you know, popped twice before for her bad behavior. I mean, maybe it.
But it would be equally true if she's an at-will employee, she could be fired for nothing.
She can be fired for nothing, but she cannot be fired for an illegal reason, and the agency's own procedures acknowledge that, which is why we're here. With respect to silence and speech, let me say quickly, even a speech case must satisfy Establishment Clause concerns, and the Supreme Court acknowledged that in the court's opinion in Garcetti. Now, this is not a speech case. This case is an Establishment Clause case because it's about how the Texas Education Agency produces and monitors and reviews its science curriculum. That's the issue. And what's offensive about the reason that they fired her is they said, you must do your job with one hand tied behind your back. You must pull your punch if a question about is creationism science comes up. And when the punch gets pulled, that's a reflection of treating creationism as something that it's not. And it has the effect in this realm of elevating it, if you will, to be a matter of science. And I say that cautiously because they're two different things, and one is not better than the other, but they cannot be equated. So it's not about silence. It's about them firing their director of science, an act which resonated throughout the science education community, prompting 121 biology professors to write to the Commissioner of Education protesting that when it comes to creationism and evolution, there's nothing to be neutral about. There's no debate. This is an attempt to do indirectly what the cases have made clear cannot be done directly. And unless the court has any further questions, I'll stand down. Thank you, Your Honor.